today on Against the Grain. If you're in prison and you violate a rule or policy, you could be sent to solitary confinement. What if you violate rules while in solitary? I'm CS. A new book by Terry Cooper examines the culture of punishment and impunity within Supermax prison facilities. He joins me, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Solitary confinement is an exceptionally harsh form of punishment. It means little or no meaningful contact with other human beings for sometimes months or years at a time. And solitary confinement can inflict a tremendous amount of damage, mental and emotional. It can also, according to Terry Cooper's, lead to situations in which the person in solitary violates prison rules and then is subjected to additional punitive measures of escalating severity. What then? Do such measures produce docility and compliance, or do they foment resistance, which invites more abuse? What does it mean that, to get out of solitary, a person has to snitch on other prisoners? And what can be done in prison to promote, rather than undermine, inmates' emotional stability and prospects for rehabilitation? Terry Coopers is a psychiatrist who has testified in over 24 class action lawsuits about prison conditions, the quality of mental health care for incarcerated people, and the effects of sexual abuse behind bars. He is Professor Emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology, and his new book is Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. When Terry Coopers joined me recently in studio, he began by explaining the terms Supermaximum Security Unit and SHU, which stands for Security Housing Unit.
The term supermax confinement has been around since around the 1990s. Actually, the Adjustment Center at San Quentin was a model for the type of unit. It's entire units or entire prisons of solitary confinement cells where nobody is out doing congregate activities. Rather, everybody is in their cell, eats their meals in their cells, has little to do. There's almost no programming. Often there are no windows, for instance, at Pelican Bay State Prison in California. And the day is just total monotony sitting in a cell. SHU is the acronym from California Security Housing Unit, and it became the national buzzword for supermax solitary confinement.
So the two words are used interchangeably?
Yes. A SHU is usually a part of a prison or a prison system that is solitary confinement. Supermax is either a building, a cell block or a unit that's entirely solitary confinement cells, or an entire prison.
So can solitary confinement happen in a unit not designated supermax security?
Well, the designation didn't exist at the time. Actually, it started in Marion, Illinois, in a federal prison in the early 1980s, I believe 1981, an officer was killed. And the entire prison was shut down. They left the prison shut down for years. So this means it's a prison that was not constructed to house people in solitary confinement, but everybody was confined to their cell 24 hours a day for years on end. And now, with the rise of solitary confinement units in most prisons in the United States, it's often called the Marionization of the prisons. So that was the 1980s. What happened was there was massive violence in the prisons in the 80s, and I think that was mostly due to crowding, massive crowding. There's 7 to 10 times as many people in prison today as there were in the 1970s, and the dismantling of rehabilitation programs. So you had a whole huge number of people crowded into small places and idle, and they got into trouble. So at the time in the 80s, I was asked what should be done, and I said we should downsize the prisons. For instance, stop sending people with low-level drug offenses to prisons, reduce the population so the staff can effectively program with the people who are there. and reinstate rehabilitation, because people who are learning the skills they'll need to succeed after they're released to prison are less likely to get into trouble. Well, the powers that be disregarded that advice and made what I call a historic wrong turn. They decided to lock up the worst of the worst. So they took units like the Adjustment Center at San Quentin, which already existed, and they filled it with prisoners who they considered the worst of the worst. And that process kept growing until today. There's over 100,000 people in solitary confinement.
Why typically is a person in prison placed in a solitary confinement unit?
The answer varies from region to region. In California, the solitary confinement units, the SHUs, were used mainly for gang affiliation. That is, prisoners who the authorities assumed are related to the gangs. They're sometimes correct about that and very often wrong in making that allegation. But in any case, in California, a person affiliated with a gang or a member of a gang would be locked in a SHU from then on. It would be an indeterminate sentence.
That status alone, regardless of any other conduct or behavior behind bars.
That's correct. In other states, disciplinary tickets, breaking a rule, getting into a fight, warrants a ticket, and the punishment for the ticket might be a certain time, and that would be a determinant sentence in SHU or solitary confinement. So there are many different reasons in different states that people are put in solitary. What's consistent across the states and the federal system is that 4 or 6 or 8% of the prison population would eventually be consigned to solitary confinement.
How rural-bound is prison life in the United States?
Prison life is incredibly rule-bound. That is, as soon as you walk into the prison, you are handed a book of rules and told that if you break the rules, you will be punished harshly. So there are rules about where you can walk, what you can wear, what activities you can participate in, who you can talk to. And these rules, there are really rules upon rules. And then the punishment for each of the rules, if you break them, are increasingly harsh. And solitary confinement is at the top of the pyramid of harshness. That is, you can be punished with loss of visits, with loss of telephone calls, with loss of commissary, with confinement to your cell for a short period. But the worst punishment is that you can be placed in solitary confinement either indeterminately or for a very long time.
And I imagine the punishments doled out, they increase in severity as the violation of the rule is considered or deemed to be more severe?
Yes, that's generally true, but the system is imperfect. So that, for instance, race plays a role. If a white prisoner breaks a rule, certain things happen. And if a black prisoner breaks the same rule in the same way, usually the punishment is going to be more harsh. So it's a complicated mix of how the punishments are determined.
So are people of color or African Americans, are they more likely to end up in solitary confinement?
Absolutely. First of all, as everyone knows, they're more likely to end up in prison. At every level of our criminal justice system, there is massive racial discrimination. So, for instance, studies show that middle-class kids in a white suburb use about as much illicit substances as black or Latino kids in the inner city. However, the arrest rate is much higher in the inner city. Then the number of people arrested who go to trial is much greater with people of color. Then the result is usually a longer sentence and they go to prison, so that we have the stunning statistic nationally that somewhere between 40% and 50% of prisoners are African American. There's only 13% African American people in the population, so it's a reflection of the racism of our society. Now, when people enter prison, it doesn't stop. The treatment units, the mental health treatment unit, for instance, will have some people of color in it, but disproportionately it'll be white prisoners. You walk into a punishment area like the Supermax SHU, and you will see disproportionately people of color.
So when a prisoner in the general population of a prison violates a rule or violates a certain rule, he or she may be assigned to solitary confinement. What happens when a person in solitary breaks a rule?
Well, that is a huge problem nationally. Here we have, I just said, the harshest punishment is solitary confinement. So someone does something to get themselves placed in solitary, or in very many cases, a large proportion of cases, they've done nothing but they're placed in solitary confinement. In solitary confinement, there are various symptoms that emerge, and we've seen this. I've studied the inhabitants of solitary confinement in probably 30 states, and I find very consistent patterns of symptomatology. High anxiety, disordered thinking and paranoia, despair. One of the things that is almost universally reported is mounting anger. And the prisoners in solitary will tell me, I don't know why I'm so angry. It's not about an event that happens. I just find the anger welling up inside of me. And then universally they tell me, and I'm afraid to death, that my anger is going to make me talk back to a guard, and I'm going to get a longer term in SHU. So what happens is that in the SHU, where the doors are open and closed automatically, there's almost no contact with human beings, officers pass food trays through a slot in a door, which may be a solid metal door, the prisoners, without knowing why it's happening, get angry, talk back, throw their food tray, do something outrageous. Now, they're not going to harm anybody. They're locked in a cell. However, now the officers are going to have to design a worse punishment. So what they're going to do at Pelican Bay SHU in northern part of California, there are no phone calls. People who are in the SHU do not get phone calls. They can have visits, but the place is very far away, so they get few visits. But they get no phone calls. In other SHUs, they do get phone calls, maybe one a week. The phone calls can be taken away. They get commissary, which means someone comes around with a tray and says, do you want a candy bar or a detergent? And their commissary is canceled. They may or may not have a television in their cell. They have to be able to afford one. They have to buy specific televisions approved by the Department of Corrections. But they may have a television, and if they get into disciplinary trouble in the SHU, the television will be taken away, so they'll even be more idle.
Terry Coopers joins me. He is a psychiatrist and professor emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology, and his new book is Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. It's published by University of California Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Now, you write in this book, and I think you were about to tell me, that the punishments can get more severe and more brutal and more harmful to the prisoner, to the person in solitary who is violating a rule, perhaps because, as you said, rage builds up and he or she feels like they have to do something. So in Montana State Prison, there was a man named Edward Walker. Tell us his story.
Mr. Walker was someone who was suffering from serious mental illness. He suffered from bipolar disorder with psychotic episodes, meaning he both had psychosis and a mood disorder. He had previously been in the Colorado Department of Corrections, and prior to entering prison the first time, his psychiatrists had found a dose of lithium which worked for him and kept him fairly stable. When he entered the Colorado Department of Corrections, he was prescribed the lithium, and he had a record in the general population in Colorado for several years of absolutely no disciplinary infractions.
So he was doing fine.
He was doing fine. He finished his term, and he was released. He got in trouble in Montana, was tried and sent to prison. And the psychiatrist at Montana State Prison decided that he did not suffer from a mental illness and he would not receive lithium and he would just have to cope in the general population. Well, he got into some fights, and partly I think it's because his mood varied and sometimes he got out of control, and he got put in solitary confinement. Then I was called by his attorney, who said that what's happening to him in solitary is just awful. And what was happening is that he had just dozens of disciplinary infractions because he would get into a manic or a psychotic state and he would cuss the officer who would write him a ticket. So he accumulated dozens and dozens of tickets, and then they had to figure out a way to punish him further. One thing they do is cell extractions. And I can talk more about that, but let me talk for a moment about behavior management plans. This is a procedure by policy where someone who's already in solitary confinement and is not behaving is put on a special diet, which is little cubes of basically mashed leftovers from the day before. The prisoners tell me it's inedible. The prison system tells me it meets dietary requirements. All of their clothes are taken away, their bed sheets, but also their mattress is taken away. They have to sleep on a concrete platform that's made for the bed. And they're put on this behavior management plan supposedly for 3 days. However, what happens and what happened to Mr. Walker is that while they're at this extreme degree of deprivation, they don't behave right. It doesn't help their behavior. So they give sass to the guard again, and they're told they've got another 3 days. And in this way, he would spend weeks in this absolute state of deprivation. This is a policy-mandated punishment beyond solitary confinement, which I think qualifies as torture in the definitions of the international community.
Yeah, and I guess the idea or the theory might be, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that if you punish people who violate a rule and therefore are given a ticket, then they will learn that that behavior is unacceptable and they will not do it again. What you're saying is the scenario can be quite different.
Well, yes, and that is accurate. What you said is what the authorities in corrections would argue, even the psychologists in correction. In psychology in general and psychiatry, we are firmly committed to the view that positive rewards work much better than punishments to affect improved behavior. And in reality, that's true. The harsh punishments of solitary confinement and everything else that's done to people in solitary do not improve their behavior. Generally, it causes grave psychiatric damage and makes them more and more disabled for the future.
And you also write in this book, Solitary, the inside story of supermax isolation and how we can abolish it, that people, and people with serious mental illness, but I think other people as well, that they're not inclined to accept punishment, that they are likely to resist it and really maybe even not understand why it's being applied. And so maybe in resisting the punishment that is supposed to make them docile and compliant, they are inviting more punishment.
Well, there are such people, and I think it's worth talking about them. For the most part, people in solitary confinement try to conform their behavior to what's expected of them, and they try to get along with the officers so they can get out of solitary. But there's an issue for all prisoners, and I think all of us, and that is about respect. People who go to prison have been in various ways disrespected from a very early age, and particularly by police patrolling their community. And then when they're put in jail and tried, they're disrespected by the criminal justice system. When they get to prison, they've built up quite a bit of animosity about the lack of respect. In solitary confinement, the respect is even worse. Officers don't really have conversations for the most part with prisoners in solitary. They bark orders at them, and then the prisoners feel disrespected. They're also, if they're going to have mental health treatment, they have to be placed in a cage in order to receive the treatment, and they feel like they're being treated like animals. So they feel very disrespected. And what prisoners who get into trouble, because they will. They'll throw things at officers. Sometimes they'll throw excrement at officers. And when I talk to prisoners who have done that, and I ask them, what happened? What's this about? You're usually a very functional human being. And they'll say, I just get to the point I can't take it anymore. I can't stand this disrespect, and I have to stand up for myself.
So what is cell extraction? And I understand that something called, or something you call, immobilizing gas is also used in conjunction with it.
A cell extraction, let me start with hospital, psychiatric hospital. We do what's called a takedown. When a patient is totally out of control and is threatening violence and breaking things, what we do in psychiatry is we gather the staff, because there's safety in numbers. So the nurses, the psych techs, the janitor, the psychiatrist surround the person, and we say in as gentle a way as possible, we're not going to let you do this. You need to sit here, and we're either going to put restraints on you, or we're going to give you a shot, or whatever's going to happen. And it's usually a fairly peaceful process. But if we have to, we grab the person and bring him down. And the more people surrounding him, the safer that is. In prison, it's a whole different story. The prisoner is in a solitary confinement cell. Let me mention that well over half the prisoners in our state and federal prisons are suffering from serious mental illness. So an awful lot of people with serious mental illness are in these solitary confinement cells. And when they do something that is not permissible, and usually this involves refusing an order, in order to leave their cell, they have to back up to the door, stoop down, and put their hands through the food port so that the officers on the other side of the door can put handcuffs on. Well, if a prisoner is upset, he's very often will say, I refuse to do that. First of all, it's disrespectful that you want me to do that. Or, in many cases, they'll refuse to return their food tray. In my experience, usually that's because the food was rotten, or there were bugs in it, or something was wrong, and they want to talk to somebody about the quality of the food. In any case, the officers will come by and say, either you do this or we're going to do a cell extraction. And by this time, it has gotten so hostile of a situation that the prisoners say, well, come on in. If you're man enough to take me down, do it. And that's ridiculous for the prisoner to say that. It's at a state where he's lost control, really, because they will assemble a squad of 5 or 6 officers. I call it ice hockey uniforms they wear. They have knee pads on. They have bulletproof vests. They have a helmet. They have a gas mask. They will assemble outside the cell. Now, at this point, I would hope they would talk to the prisoner and try to talk him down and get him to either agreed to put his hands out and cuff up or to return the food tray. Usually they don't. Once they've decided to do a cell extraction, they're going to go right ahead and do it. They stick a canister of pepper spray. I'm told that mace is not used in American prisons, but I don't know about that. It might be mace. But they put immobilizing gases, pepper spray or mace. They spray into the prisoner's cell. That's why the officers are wearing gas masks. And the prisoner is then coughing and is supposed to give up at that point and say, okay, I'll cuff up or I'll return the food tray. If the prisoner doesn't do that, they open the cell door. They all burst in at once. One person is carrying a shield, which may have a taser on it, where there's electrical current that'll, as soon as they touch the prisoner, they will turn the current on and that'll cause a huge shock. And then 4 other officers are assigned to grab 1 limb each. So they slam the prisoner against the far wall of the cell, everybody grabs a limb, and they do what in prison is called a cell extraction, or it's generically, it's a takedown. Usually there are injuries. The gas has caused problems. For instance, people with asthma have much worse asthma after they're gassed in this procedure. And it's just a totally traumatic experience all around.
And disproportionate is your point.
Yes.
Terry Coopers is my guest. He's an award-winning psychiatrist, and he has testified in over 24 class action lawsuits about jail and prison conditions, the quality of mental health care for incarcerated people, and the effects of sexual abuse behind bars. He's the author of Prison Madness, the Mental Health Crisis Behind Bars and What We Must Do About It. And we are discussing his new book. It's called Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you write about the lack of contact, of meaningful contact between people in solitary and the corrections officers who guard them. Has this always been the case, this sense of alienation and this sense of hostility between prisoner and prison guard?
No, it has not. I mean, there were always abuses in prison, and there was always what was called the hole, where people would be put, usually for a short time, 10 days for fighting or something like that. But prison officers were very much in a supportive role until the advent of the Supermax. That is, the officers would walk on the yard or in the day room and would interact with prisoners in an informal way. And in many cases, they would be described as almost a big brother. And they would ask the prisoner whether he was doing his homework or he's looking a little overweight. Maybe he should be exercising. They'd talk about whether the prisoner should be taking college classes. And they would be supportive in various ways. Now, there was a lot of racism in the prisons, and there was a lot of brutal, unfair beatings going on. But there was a certain rapport between officers and prisoners. Once the advent of the Supermax occurred, the officers don't really need to talk to the prisoners. The prisoners are warehoused in their cell, and they're passing them a food tray. They don't need to talk to them. In fact, they rarely do. And I've been present many times during the passing of food trays in a Supermax unit. There's no conversation that goes on. So really, the prisoner is left entirely, extremely alone. And the officers are not really used to talking to prisoners.
Now, one would hope that the more benevolent or respectful staff, they must exist, would complain about abuses inflicted on prisoners by other staffers, other colleagues. Is the system set up to make that possible or probable?
Well, the system is set up very much to keep that from happening. There are a lot of prison officers who mean well and actually are doing their work in the criminal justice system with the hope of helping some people straighten out their life, people who at a young age got into crime and or substance abuse, and have some potential with the right education and the right social relations to turn their life around and succeed. There are such officers, I don't know what percentage. However, I believe that what happens in prison, and especially in the Supermax units, is that the more brutal, sadistic officers gain some kind of control. For instance, they set the mood in a Supermax unit. So I have visited Supermax units where wholesale cell extractions occur. And when I explore why that happens, it turns out that one or a few officers actually initiated all of the cell extractions. So the first question is, why isn't there pushback from the other officers who say, we don't need to do a cell extraction here? And the reason is, I find ultimately, is the blue code. That is, officers have a stronger no-snitch rule than the prisoners. Prisoners have a code, and the code is about being tough, not showing your feelings or your weakness, and absolutely don't snitch. Well, the officers have a code, and it's called the Blue Code, and it involves not snitching. I've done a lot of work with sexual abuse in prison, which in men's prisons, the perpetrator and the victim are both prisoners. In women's prisons, the perpetrator is usually staff, and the women are sexually abused or raped by officers in many cases. I have investigated cases where I find that one officer raped a woman prisoner, but six other officers knew it was going on because they had to open the doors by remote control. They passed the place where the rape was occurring, but no officer would inform on their colleagues. And that is the blue code. In order to run a decent prison, there needs to be a zero-tolerance attitude. And the administration needs to tell the officers, when you see something where the rules or the laws are broken, you need to report. And not reporting should be as serious a crime as doing the actual illegal act, such as raping a prisoner. That rarely happens in the United States.
Terry Kupers is his name, K-U-P-E-R-S. He has 40 years' experience as a forensic psychiatrist. He's a frequent consultant to the ACLU's National Prison Project and to Human Rights Watch. And his book is Solitary, the inside story of supermax isolation and how we can abolish it. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Terry. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Terry Kupers is Professor Emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology. He's an award-winning psychiatrist, and his new book is called Solitary. It's about solitary confinement and supermax isolation in the United States. You referred briefly earlier this hour to symptoms that people develop as a result of being in solitary confinement. Tell us more about symptoms experienced and emotional harm suffered.
Well, the symptoms vary on the individual's condition before going into a solitary confinement cell. So let's take the case of someone who's relatively stable, and they go into a solitary cell and they say, well, I did the crime, I can do the time, and I'll be fine. They start feeling overwhelming anxiety. Many call it panic attacks. They start doing repetitive acts like pacing in their cell or cleaning their cell many times a day. They start having disordered thinking where they get confused. Many get paranoid. They become despairing. That is, they think they will never get out. They have problems concentrating, and their memory is impaired. So many people tell me that they don't read, and they're literate. And I say, well, why not? If I was in a solitary cell, I'd read all the time. And they say, well, I forget what I read 3 pages ago. So, and then suicide is a big problem. We have a stunning statistic that in any given prison system, I'm talking about the state system or the federal system, 50% of suicides on average occur among the 4 or 6 or 8% of prisoners who are in solitary confinement at any given time. So that's about as close as you can get to a causal relationship from a statistical correlation. So those are symptoms that are very universal among people who have been in solitary, who are stable. Now, people who come in with a serious mental illness, and I'm thinking of the big three of schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or major depressive disorder, their mental illness is greatly exacerbated. The risk of suicide becomes sky high. And not only does their mental illness become worse, but it becomes more disabling and their prognosis becomes worse. And that's because in psychiatry, we believe, on average, the more quickly and effectively we treat an emotional condition, for instance, a psychotic episode in someone with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, the better they will do in the long run. The quicker we gain a remission, for instance, having them stop illicit substances and take their prescribed medications and participate in group therapy and other treatment modalities, the better they're going to be over time. Well, the opposite is also true, and that is if we don't treat them adequately, if we brutalize and traumatize them while they're going through their episode of psychosis or depression or suicidal crisis, and we don't give them the treatment they need, their condition is going to get worse, it's going to become more chronic, they're going to be more disabled, and therefore their long-term prognosis is going to be much worse. That is the population of people that we are creating in our prisons and solitary confinement units.
There is something called SHU, and again, SHU is Security Housing Unit, which is a solitary confinement unit or a building composed of solitary confinement cells. SHU post-release syndrome, what's that?
Well, I coined that term. In the Ashker case, which was a class action lawsuit initiated by the prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison in the SHU, they went on hunger strike to make public the awful conditions in the SHU and to make their very reasonable demands public. At the time they went on the hunger strike, there were 6,000 prisoners in California went on hunger strike in sympathy with them. Then a lawsuit occurred. The Center for Constitutional Rights stepped in and sued over a lack of due process, a unacceptably long term in SHU for each of these people, and other harsh conditions and unconstitutional measures. I was asked to be an expert witness in that lawsuit, and as part of my investigation, the lawsuit involved a class of prisoners who had been in SHU for 10 years or longer. But some of those prisoners would be released during the course of the lawsuit, released either to go into a general population prison or to go home because their sentence was over. Among the group of people that I selected to interview to be ready to testify in that case were 10 or 12 who actually had been released from SHU in the meantime. And I talked with them not only about their experience in SHU, but what was it like to get out of the SHU. And they all, for instance, told me that for months or longer after they were released from the SHU, they would stay in their room. Their room would either be a prison cell in the general population prison or their room at home if they were released to the community. And I thought, that's interesting. What a uniform answer I'm getting. And I asked them what their emotional state was like, and they described anxiety. They described continuing problems concentrating, problems with memory, and they described a fear of being with other people. They had been in solitary confinement so long, it made them very paranoid when they were around people they didn't know. So, for instance, a typical response was, I have worked up with a lot of effort to the ability to walk to the corner store to get milk, but I cannot handle a supermarket. There's too many people, they're coming from too many different directions, too much noise. Well, this is all part of the SHU post-release syndrome. It makes people very dysfunctional. Now think, if you're unable to leave your room or frightened in a supermarket, how are you going to do at a job application? So they're really not ready to go out and find work. And all of these things I put together and called the SHU post-release syndrome.
One thing the hunger strikers at Pelican Bay State Prison, and I think a lot of other prisoners around the state who struck in sympathy with these strikers at Pelican Bay, wanted was an end to what's called the debriefing policy. What's that?
The debriefing is a California Department of Correction and Rehabilitation policy that if you are consigned to SHU, to solitary confinement, in order to get out, you have to tell the authorities everything you know about the scene inside the prison, including the gangs, who's in a gang, what illegal acts the gang did. In other words, snitching, according to the prisoner's code. If you don't debrief, then you will never get out of the SHU. So universally, the people I interviewed at Pelican Bay told me they were getting terrible medical care. They had serious illnesses like diabetes or bone problems in their back or their knee. And they would tell the doctor that they need better treatment. And the doctor would say, if you want better treatment, you better debrief and get out of here. And then you can go to Vacaville or a place where they have better medical care. So there was always a lot of pressure to debrief. What happens typically when someone is put in SHU is the officers come to them, and, you know, the officers don't know who's in a gang, and they see two Latino men with tattoos giving each other a high five. They think one of them is in a gang, so they assume the other one must be in a gang, too. They put him in the SHU. Now, if he says to them, "I'm not affiliated with a gang. I don't know what you're doing this for," they say, "We don't care. If you want to get out of here, you have to debrief." So there's a tremendous amount of pressure around debriefing. And very often, I think even in a majority of cases, it's about a false conviction for an in-prison rule-breaking or drug affiliation, that more than half the time they're wrong about that.
So you've begun to answer this question, but this logic of escalating punishment and control within prison and within solitary confinement areas, what does that do to the prospects that the prisoner in confinement who is being punished will be able to avoid doing something once outside prison that gets him back inside prison?
Well, this is the core of the whole matter, and the way I summarize it is this. We want to make very sure that what we do to people when they're in prison makes them less likely rather than more likely to use drugs and do crimes once they get out. That's the general, overall, absolute rule for good correctional methodology. And that informs an intensive rehabilitation program, and rehabilitation programs work. Another name for SHU is control unit. All control is taken away from the prisoner, and the prisoner is made to obey orders, comply, and not to talk back. Now, those qualities are not exactly functional for someone who gets out of prison. We're talking about someone who only knows how to follow rules, who is compliant in all situations, particularly with officers' commands, who initiates nothing on their own, and has no sense of any kind of larger project or agency that they might be capable of. That's absolutely the worst thing to do to people if we want them to succeed after they get out of prison. The reason people talk about a prison industrial complex is that our prison system consistently does things to people which are going to make it more likely that they return to substances and crime after they get out. And that makes us wonder, why are they doing that? It must be that the implicit aim of the correctional system is not to help people go straight after they get out of prison. Rather, the aim is to break them and make sure that when they get out of prison, they will be dysfunctional, damaged, and likely to commit more crimes.
Terry Coopers, psychiatrist, professor emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology, and author of the new book, Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. And whenever he says SHU, think a solitary confinement. You devote a chapter in your book to what you call the rehabilitative attitude. What is that?
Well, for this entire interview, we've been talking about what I call a culture of punishment. That is the main guide to social interactions between prisoners and their keepers, is a set of rules, and if they violate the rules, they get punished harshly, solitary confinement and cell extractions being part of the punishment. This is not the way to help people change their behavior and learn to function in society. What's needed instead, and it's in direct contradiction to that approach, what's needed is a rehabilitative attitude. That attitude is that there should be mutual respect at all times. The prisoners should be helped to develop their agency. That is to be in the driver's seat in their own life. So when they get out of prison, they can make a plan for themselves. They can initiate things like a search for a job, a relationship, etc. What we want is for them to feel respected. We want them to keep their eye on the future. When prisoners are denied phone calls, visits, and mail, which is very frequent, and they're not allowed sources of information about what's going on in the world. The censoring that goes on in prison is unbelievable. So they're not allowed, for instance, black prisoners are not allowed to read books that are written by black peers. And the reason is because the authorities say that's subversive, that they'll be planning some kind of rebellion in the prison. And they're so phobic about the prisoners being rebellious that they take away all opportunity for respect and agency. That is the wrong approach. The rehabilitative attitude is the opposite, to let the prisoners have as much agency as is possible within the structure of their confinement, to help them to envision a future where they have a job that's meaningful to them, a relationship that's meaningful, to do everything we can to support relationships with loved ones, educational pursuits. That's all part of the rehabilitative attitude. It does exist, and in fact, in recent years, we have been moving more and more towards a rehabilitative attitude. And the reason is that a lot of correctional authorities have realized that solitary confinement doesn't work and that they're damaging a lot of prisoners so they won't be able to succeed after they're released. Therefore, there's a new look at rehabilitation and its possibilities. There's sentencing reform, which will reduce the population in the prison and makes it possible for the individuals who remain in prison to receive adequate mental health treatment, adequate rehabilitation preparation to succeed when they are released. And there's been a consensus building in corrections that that's the direction we want to go more and more. I'm concerned about that consensus and what's happened with the new federal administration and how it might interfere with that.
To what extent are young people, I guess they would officially be called juvenile offenders, being placed in solitary? And what effect does solitary confinement have on youth?
Well, the answer to the second part of your question is solitary confinement is much more harmful to youth than it is to adults for a number of complicated reasons, partly because of the stage of brain formation that they're in. What we have right now in this country is an extremely unfortunate trend to do away with the juvenile justice system. The juvenile justice system, which has been in place from the late 19th century until the 1970s, was premised on the idea that juveniles are different. First of all, they haven't had a long time to be criminals, and we might be able to change them. Second of all, their brain is not fully mature, so if we put them into the right programs, for instance, education and supervised social interactions where there's love and respect, they will be much different people, and they need the education that they should be getting during these years. So the juvenile facilities will be very education-oriented. Well, around the country, there are laws being passed. For instance, in Michigan, if you're 17 and committed any crime, you are tried as an adult. In California still, the judge controls whether you're tried as an adult or a child. The prosecutor can say this 14-year-old did this heinous crime and I want him tried as an adult. And the judge can say, well, let me hear evidence about that and we'll make a decision. In Michigan, automatically, if you're 17, you're tried as an adult. In New York, it's 16. So what happens is a huge number of very young people who haven't completed their education, their high school education, are very unformed as human beings and very vulnerable. And there's a saying in prison, if you have peach fuzz, you are going to get challenged to fight and probably you're going to be forced into sexual liaison. So the youngsters coming into prisons, you know, at an age where they're going to be attacked because they're young, they're fair, they're vulnerable, they will do either something like punch a guard, which in the prisoner code, there's nothing dishonorable about punching a guard. There is something dishonorable about saying, I don't feel safe, I want protection. And then you're considered a sissy or a weakling from then on. But if you punch a guard, then you're thrown into solitary confinement. Now you're separated from the attackers who would rape you, and you're sitting in solitary confinement. The problem is, as I started out my answer, solitary confinement causes great harm, and all the symptoms I named for adults are actually multiplied with juveniles.
So what you've been telling me about abuse and punishment in prison is pretty horrifying. How can abuse by prison officers be addressed? What kinds of steps can be taken?
Well, we need a comprehensive plan. That's a very complicated issue. First of all, there are simple changes in the rules. If an officer is convicted or found by a prison hearing to have sexually abused, for instance, a woman prisoner, that officer can leave the state, go to another state, and apply for a job as a prison guard. That should be ended. That is, that the background checks of officers should be extensive. The training should be extensive. Now, things are possible that we never think of in this country. For instance, in Scandinavia, the staff of the prisons aren't really guards. What they are, they usually have a master's degree or the equivalent, and the degree is in three subjects. One is security, which is how to be a guard. One is education and how to teach these people the skills and the knowledge they need. And the third is counseling. And all staff are trained in all three of those areas. We could demand that here. What's wrong with, you know, in California, prison guards make probably double what public school teachers make. Why couldn't we demand that they have some training in education, counseling, and custody? Then they need to be supervised. And the supervision needs to be zero tolerance. For instance, the blue code that I mentioned is not okay. Officers need to be punished for not informing on their peers who violate the rules and abuse prisoners. However, in every case that I've seen, for instance, in women's prisons where there's a widespread sexual abuse of the women by male staff, I find a lackadaisical attitude on the part of the warden or the commissioner of that state, so that they're basically giving the message, we don't care if you abuse, do whatever you need to do. We just want you to show up for work on time. And that has to stop, and there has to be very close supervision and a whole lot of other measures that will keep the prisoners safe and make sure that they get the kind of experience in prison that'll prepare them for success at going straight.
The book is Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. The author, my guest, is Terry Coopers, again, Kuperes. He is an award-winning psychiatrist, and he's also professor emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology. Terry, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, C.S. It's a pleasure.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.